So we're coming to the end of chapter 14. Krishna has described the modes of nature and their effects on the Bada Jiva. And in the last class, we also described the 10 items that Krishna mentioned to Uddhav in the Uddhav Gita, how we can rise up to the mode of goodness by adjusting these 10 items in our lives, food, association, work, etc. And so verse 19 is beginning the next section. This last section, how the we can called transcending the modes, how to get out of the trap of illusion of the three modes of nature. And the middle section was from 10 to 18, and that is called, or was called, characteristics, action, and death in the modes. Just in case you didn't have that. Characteristics, action, and death in the modes, from 10 to 18. And there we have, that section is divided into three subsections. The characteristics are given in verses 11 to 13, characteristics and manifestations, 11 to 13. Then death in the modes from 14 to 15. Death. And then the results of action in the modes from verses 16 to 18. Between 17 and 18. The verses. Oh, was there one? I don't know if I gave one. Right. Well, there's not connections. I mean, there are connections, but I might not know every connection through every single verse. I mean, there's no question, as far as I remember from the commentaries, there's no question which invokes verse 18 from 17. Between 14 and 15. What was that? No, that began between 13 and 14. Oh.
No, I'm just saying that what is the
All the death?
Yeah.
About dying?
Yeah.
More or less. Yeah, it's like a summary of those two. Maybe more general, because in 14 and 15 there was some more details, like Muda Yonishu, Karma Sangishu. Here in 18 it just says Madhya Tishtanti Ado Gachanti. Right? Yeah, it's like a summary of those things. A summary of the whole section. What's that noise there? That's the shop. Metal shop. Oh, they heard my question. Okay. So now here, one might ask the question, when is the soul released from these modes? From 18 to 19. And then the answer is given in 19. Nanyam gunebhyo kartaram yada drashtana pushyati Gunebhyascha param vitti madbhavam sudigacchati. When one properly sees that in all activities no other performer is at work than these modes of nature, and he knows the Supreme Lord who is transcendental to all these modes, he attains my spiritual nature. So here is a if a person has this vision, drashtanu pashyati, he can see that there's no other karta, or agent other than the gunas, other than the gunas, nanyam gunebhya kataram. So, this is the first first part of the answer. That to observe the modes working upon us, that's the first step to liberation. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has commented, when the jiva doesn't see any other active agent except for the gunas, which have been modified to become the doer, the effect, and the objects. The doer, the effect, and the objects. He realizes that the gunas alone are the active agents in every situation. He also realizes that the Atma is superior to the gunas and is different from them. Such a seer attains love for me, madbhavam, or sayujya. In other words, he attains my spiritual nature. Then he says, at that time, even after he has acquired this knowledge, he only attains me by performing bhakti. This will be clear from the meaning of the 26th verse in this chapter. Yeah. So, we can become free from the modes of nature. Prabhupada writes, one can transcend all the activities of the modes of material nature simply by understanding them properly by learning from the proper souls. And Prabhupada mentions how Krishna is Arjuna's spiritual master. And so, one has to by the instruction of the bona fide spiritual master, know his spiritual position, his material body, his senses, how he's entrapped, how he's under the spell of the modes. He's helpless being in the grip of these modes, but when he can see his real position, then he can attain to the transcendental platform, having the scope for spiritual life. So, in the beginning, one has to have some knowledge. And that comes from the spiritual master. Of course, there's different spiritual masters. There's also Vartma Pradarshak Guru and Shiksha Guru and so forth. So some guru, someone who has knowledge, is imparting that knowledge. Actually, the living entity is not the performer of different activities. He is forced to act because he is situated in a particular type of body conducted by some particular mode of nature. Unless one has the help of spiritual authority, he cannot understand in what position he is actually situated. So with the help of the guru, one can realize that. And so, the last sentence, for one who is able to see things as they are, the influence of the material nature gradually ceases. And Prabhupada gave a lecture. He said, how can we rise above the gunas, or at least to sattva gun? By hearing regularly. Then gradually, It takes time, but it's sure, he said. And that is, Kapila Muni said this also in the third canto, I guess. So after hearing after a long time, one can attain this level above the modes of nature. So this is, we're using discrimination as much as we have. And as we come to sattva gun, then discrimination increases more and more. And the spiritual master, he's also an elevated soul. So his discrimination is acute or developed. So either some advanced Vaishnava or one's Diksha Guru or any Shiksha Guru, then he might point out some behaviors of ours which we may not be able to see subjectively. And usually that's the case. You don't really see how you're behaving because you're under that particular mode and you think that's natural. Or in one sense you can say it's natural because it's prakriti, it's nature. But it's not the highest kind of behavior. And there's a lot of subtle things. Here Krishna has given just the basic lakshanas for each mode. And in later on in the Gita, chapter 17, he describes, and 18, he describes more about the modes of nature, different activities, knowledge, determination, understanding, so on and so forth, charity, work. More full description is given to help the devotee to be introspective, to see himself, how he's working, how he's eating, how he's thinking, how he's speaking. So the devotee wants to know all these things. And Arjuna asks in the second chapter, how does the person who transcended the modes, how does he speak, how does he walk? Of course, those questions had deeper meanings, but they also have some connection on the overt plane as well. So subtle behaviors also indicate some modes. And we can see, I can mention a few things. These are very insignificant things, but it kind of gets you thinking. Like in the West, and here we may also have some asanas. In the West, usually they have some kind of foam rubber and it's kind of covered by some kind of vinyl, something like this. And they stack them up, usually in the temple room, and they give them to the guests. And in India, usually they just have some other kind of asana made from something else. Here you have these kind of board, a stiff wooden thing which has some kind of cushion on it and then some red cloth on top, right? So in the West, devotees sit on these like in the temple room, and then when they're finished, it's quite common that they need to kind of just push them against the wall so that there's, they don't get in the way. And usually the way they do that is they slip their foot under it and just kind of kick it up and it flips standing up. So actually they're using their feet to, like this, in a very kind of nonchalant way. But, they don't bend down and pick it up with their hands and move it often. So this this thing was pointed out to me some years, mainly actually when I was like the first year I was in the movement. Somebody said, this indicates the propensity to lord it over the material nature, because you're touching something with your foot and you are moving it as if proving your superiority over that material energy, which is inert, and you are a conscious being. So you are kind of flexing your muscle, showing how you are lording it over the prakriti. It's a psychological thing. And of course, non-devotees, they do this all the time, and they do this with each other too. They suppress, control, and abuse and exploit one another, and they get pleasure out of that. But even devotees do that, and you can also observe this type of behavior even in inert objects. So it's much better to bend down, because actually everything is sarvam kalvidam brahma, and especially some paraphernalia in the temple room. We should be seeing it in the higher dimension, and then we should pick it up with our hand and place it, this being like more respectful. And actually you develop a more submissive and respectful mood, and in this way you become free from the desire to control and lord it over others, which is subtle sex desire. So by subtly making some adjustments just on some simple, subtle behaviors, which are somewhat insignificant, the devotee can get rid of his desire to be the Purusha, which is the glue which keeps us bound in the material world. So these behaviors can support and augment our practice of bhakti sadhana and help us to get rid of this enjoying, lording it over propensity, which is the main problem for the Bada Jiva. When I was living in the London temple some years ago, I was living in the room on the third floor, and it was that hallway in which everyone from the ashram, they had to go past. Well, there was another way, but this was the main way, that to get to the temple room and down to the street. So everybody usually would walk that way in the hallway, and I was living in the room, and I could hear the footsteps of the people in the hallway, because the place was quite small, and there was a wooden hallway. And I was living there for, like, I don't know, 5 years or something. And I got to the point where I could tell who was walking from the sound of the foot, the sound vibration they made while they were walking in the hallway, which was, you know, it's kind of interesting, because just that there's different styles of walking and different sounds. And some people had a peculiar habit of kind of stomping so heavy, it almost sounded like an elephant walking. Really, and somehow, I don't know, maybe putting all the weight on the heel, and the whole floor, and my whole room would vibrate and shake, you know. And the person walked in, and I would say, oh, I know, that's this person. And, you know, I could know, and then I would open the door, and I would say, oh, such and such Prabhu. Without even seeing with my eyes, I would be able to know who was walking there. So the heavy stomping, heavy kind of walking, also indicates this type of mood of dominance, Purusha, you know, big controller, lording it over the material nature. Just the way the person walks. Offering obeisances can also, one can also judge something, maybe about the modes of nature in the person. One time there was a servant of Srila Prabhupada who came in, and he was coming in and out quite a bit from the room, and Prabhupada's standard was that the disciple should offer obeisances every time he comes in, even if it's 100 times during the day, and when he leaves too. So the devotee was coming in and out a lot, so he was offering his obeisances, and he got to the point where it was a real quick, you know, just touching the head and just coming up, and he wouldn't say the pranam fully or barely at all. And so it got to a point where he was just going like this, and Prabhupada stopped me and said, what is this hatchet obeisances? This hatchet means like an axe. Like this. You know this word, hatchet? Hatchet is like an axe. The person is going, chuk, chuk, chuk. Now Prabhupada stopped him. What is this hatchet obeisances? Prabhupada knew all these English words. He used them appropriately, you know. Taking prasadam is also, the lakshanas can be observed of the different gunas, in even how the devotees take their prasadam. Mostly even just the time that it takes. Like Prabhupada, when he took prasadam, it was about 45 minutes each time. And generally, devotees usually take about 30 minutes, like average time. But anyway, if you're taking prasadam in less than 20 minutes, then you should know that you're probably in the mode of passion. And you're just gobbling, woofing it down, and, you know. And probably, you know, also you're not chewing it, right? You're not chewing it, so that means you'll have a harder time to digest the food. Because to actually eat food properly, you have to chew it like 40, 50 times before you swallow the food. And of course, when you get older, you know, you'll naturally take a longer time. Especially you'll have less teeth, so you'll have to chew more. It'll take more time to eat the food. But prasadam should be taken in a very peaceful and clean place. And the conversation generally should be light, so that one can taste the food. Otherwise, if you're concentrating on something else too much, you'll be eating something and you won't actually, won't be experiencing it fully. You know, whether your belly will feel some satisfaction, there'll be some lacking there because you didn't really pay attention. So actually, we should pay attention to the prasadam because it's Krishna. It's a kind of meditation. And really we think how Krishna was tasting it, how he enjoyed it, and he's given it to us. Of course, there's more gross manifestations. I mean, someone's chanting the prayer and his mouth is watering. You know, he's drooling something. You know. No, that's a different thing. We're talking about the more subtle manifestations now. Kirtan can also be done, although kirtan, the holy name is transcendental, but it can be done also in a passionate way. Especially if, in many places, the sound system is hooked, you know, it's boosted up too loud in many places. It's not necessary to have this blasting, you know, 150 decibels, you know, like a, you know, like in a rock concert or something. Better to have, I mean, the voice has to be louder than the instruments. But in order to do that, if you have to pump up the sound system so much, that means the instruments are too loud. So then generally the kirtan should be... It can get uproarious at points, but it's not that it should be always so loud. And on one occasion, Prabhupada heard one devotee in Vrindavan, and he was also using the microphone. And there's a kind of tendency to use the microphone and speak really close to the microphone. And when you're singing, that's called mouthing the microphone in the professional world, when you're too close. And then there's a kind of reverberation and a kind of, the sound, you know, feedbacks, or it gets a little distorted, right? So Prabhupada heard that somebody was singing a little bit too loud and the voice was distorted. And he said this, sounds like a rakshasa. And he said, go tell him and turn it down, turn down the volume. Sounds like a rakshasa. Similarly, when you're playing some bhajans or cassettes, it should be, you know, generally should be just loud enough to hear, but not too loud, it imposes itself on your consciousness too much. Then about being clean is also very important, because being clean, if you're not clean, you're in mode of ignorance. And if you're clean, you're in the mode of goodness. So it's a big jump from one to the other. And if you notice something's not clean, it's also incumbent upon you that you stop and take some time to clean the thing. Not that you just complain that, oh, this is dirty, why they're not cleaning it. No, you should also take time and clean, you know, even though you're not, you know, assigned a particular area. If you see places dirty, you know, you can clean it. Take 5 minutes and clean it. Why not? Like, there were, Prabhupada was walking with the sannyasis in Mayapur, and they were walking past the latrines. So Prabhupada took his cane and poked open the door, and the door swung open, and the whole thing was filled with stool, you know. And Prabhupada said, "What is that?" And the sannyasi said, "Oh, there's many devotees. I guess they didn't clean it." And he said, "But why is it left in such a condition?" He said, "Oh, we don't know, Prabhupada." And Prabhupada said, "Then he said that this is very bad." He said, "If you see this and you don't clean it," he said, "you'll become affected. It will affect you. So if you say something and it's dirty and then you leave it, that means you'll be, the mode of ignorance will enter into you." And, you know, I can't portray the exact mood and words, Prabhupada, but he was very angry at the sannyasis, and he shouted at them, and he said, "You rascals, you should clean it, or you should ensure that it's clean." So these are things in which the devotee is observing, you know, he's observing the modes of nature, and he wants to rise above the modes of nature, so he tries to act in a way which will increase his mode of goodness and decrease the lower modes. The second thing here is Krishna says that the second step for liberation is madbhavam sodigacchati. When the person also drashtanupashyati sees Lord Krishna's nature as param veti, when he sees that I am transcendental, or the living entity is transcendental to the modes, and also the Supreme Lord is transcendental to the modes, then he attains my nature. So there's different kinds of nature, my nature, depending on the transcendentalist. As the commentators mentioned, that Vishwanath Chakravarti says that someone may attain sayujya mukti, right? If he's a brahmavadi, he's performing jnana mishra bhakti, then he goes to Brahman. So these are just some kind of subtle things. At the same time, the devotee will have to recognize that as long as he has a material body, there's going to be some modes there in sleeping, in eating, in acting. There's going to be little passion, little ignorance, right? I mean, you can't go to sleep unless there's some tamagun. So then he just tolerates that, and we'll hear more about how he deals with the modes while living in the world in the next few verses. Now someone says, "What do you mean when you say my spiritual nature?" So now Krishna, in the next verse, he describes or further elaborates upon this word madbhavam. And this was something that Baladeva Vidyabhushan had written, that Krishna is explaining madbhavam in the next verse. Gunane tannatitya trindehe deha samudbhavan janma mrityu jaradhu kaira vimuktam mritam ashtute. When the embodied being is able to transcend these three modes associated with the material body, he can become free from birth, death, and their distresses, old age and their distresses, and can enjoy nectar even in this life. So this is the results of transcendence. So dehi means the embodied. So although you're in the body, by this spiritual knowledge, You can rise above the modes of nature. And you can enjoy happiness even in this body. Prabhupada says, and after leaving this body, he's certainly going to the spiritual sky. And that is another cause of his happiness. So Krishna's nature is that he's transcendental to birth, death, old age, and distress. And so the devotee also becomes transcendental to these things. Now, Arjuna asks a question, and Krishna's answer takes up the rest of the chapter. Well, actually, he asks three questions, and the answers go to the end of the chapter. Arjuna vacha kailingai strin gulanitan atito bhavati prabhu kim achara katam chaitangs strin gulanati vartate. Arjuna inquired, my dear Lord, by which symptoms is one known who is transcendental to these three modes? What is his behavior and how does he transcend the modes of nature? So in the second chapter, Arjuna asked for the symptoms of the sthita pragya, but he never asked how does he come to this platform. So now he further develops this idea, and he actually asked this question, how to become sthita pragya. And he calls Krishna Prabhu. Oh Prabhu. So Prabhu means he who is capable of performing all activities marvelously. And so Arjuna feels that only Krishna can answer Arjuna's questions about transcending the modes of nature. So he says, Kai Lingai Trin Gunanitan. What are the symptoms? So Prabhupada paraphrases the commentary of Baladeva Vidyabhushan in his purport. Prabhupada writes, he first inquires of the symptoms of such a transcendental person, and he explains what that means in the next sentence. How can one understand that he has already transcended the influence of the modes of material nature? The second question is, Kim Achara? What is his behavior? And Prabhupada writes, the second question asks how he lives and what his activities are. Are they regulated or non-regulated? So there's some idea of what he's referring to, what Arjuna is referring to. And then the third one is Katangs Chayetans. Then how does he actually do this? Or you could say, katam ativartate. Right? So how does he actually get there? So he didn't ask this before, how to become sthita pragya. So now he's asking. So we can see there's a development, and Arjuna is becoming more eager to know more. And so Prabhupada writes, then Arjuna inquires of the means by which he can attain the transcendental nature. That is very important. Unless one knows the direct means by which one can be situated transcendentally, there is no possibility of showing the symptoms. So these are important questions. Prabhupada writes, very important. And then the Lord is answering them in this next group, 22 to 25. Krishna answers the first two questions. In verse 22, he answers the first question about the symptoms. And this symptoms, or this answer to the first question, is the qualities are perceivable only by the person himself. These are perceivable to himself only. Whereas the second question, what is his behavior, referring to the next three verses, are describing qualities which are perceivable by others. Now we will chant these four verses. Shri Bhagavanu Bacha Prakasham Cha Pravrittim Cha Moham Eva Cha Pandava Nadveshti Sampravrittani Na Nivrittani Kankshati Udasina Vadasino Gunelyo Na Vichalyate Guna Vartanta Ityevam Yo Vachishtati Ningate Samadhuka Sukha Svastha Samaloshta Shma Kanchana Turya Priya Priyo Dhiras Turya Nindatma Samstuti Mana Pamana Yos Turyas Turyo Mitrare Pakshayo Savarambha Parityagi Guratita sa uchate. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear. That's the first verse. So we'll talk about that first, and then read the rest. So the words the Lord uses, prakasham, pravittim, and moha. So he used these words before in describing the modes. And though I used to ponder, what does this mean? Because in English it's not very clear what the Lord is referring to. But when you look back at the previous verses, it becomes very clear he's talking about goodness, passion, and ignorance. Right? Because these are the main symptoms of goodness, passion, ignorance. Prakasham is goodness. Pravrittim means activity in passion. And moha is the main symptom of ignorance. So what about those things? Na dveshti, na kankshati. He doesn't hate them or envy them. And he doesn't hanker for them. So he doesn't hanker for the symptoms or the energies of the three modes of nature. And he doesn't hate them or feel envy, I guess. He doesn't have any evil feelings. Prabhupada writes, Krishna first indicates that a person transcendentally situated has no envy and does not hanker for anything. So this is the main symptom. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written, it seems that Prabhupada has used some of his statements in his purport. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote that Krishna answers, the answer to the first question is freedom from envy and desire. The three questions are only, the three gunas are only destroyed upon attaining full mukti. Until then, one should know that the process to become nirgun is to give up envy and desire. As long as one has a body, there will certainly be prakash, pravritti, and moha, or goodness, passion, and ignorance. But you should not yearn for them, nor should you try to renounce them out of aversion. Those who engage in material activities with great effort due to self-motive, or who practice forced renunciation, considering the world illusory, are not nirguna. So that means that the person recognizes that as long as the body is going to be alive, there's going to be some modes of nature. And so he doesn't hate them or get angry or when he's going to the market, to buy some bhoga to give, you know, to offer for the Lord. There may be a lot of activity, people beeping the horn, people shouting, people purchasing, running back and forth, carrying things, and there's, you know, a lot of passion. But he doesn't feel hatred for that passion, either, you know, which is surrounding him, or sometimes he may see some passion also in himself. He doesn't, you know, feel hatred like this. But he realizes that, yes, this is there, and he's neutral. So he just kind of tolerates it. But then when he comes back to the ashram, then he doesn't think about, oh yeah, that was very, you know, exciting, going to the market and all those people. Actually, I wanted to, you know, kind of talk with them, and I wanted to also run back and forth and go shopping and look at all of the different things like them. He doesn't hanker for the same kind of activity in the modes of nature. So he just kind of tolerates it and is neutral to these things. Prabhupada writes that when he's actually out of the body, then he's out of the clutches of the material modes of nature. But as long as he's not out of the material body, he should be neutral. It's the same statement of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He says that, okay, one does not need this material body, and he does not need to accept the dictations of the body. The qualities of the material modes in the body will act, but his spirit soul, the self, is aloof from such activities. How does he become aloof? He does not desire to enjoy the body, nor does he desire to get out of it. Thus transcendentally situated, the devotee becomes automatically free. He need not try to become free from the influence of the modes of material nature. By performing devotional service, he does these things. Huh? That's why one need not try to become free for the influence of the modes of nature. Yeah, because in one sense you can't do that anyway. You know what I mean? As we said, that as long as the body is alive, and he also says, there's going to be these modes. And it's not that you want to just get out of here. Let me just get out of this body somehow so I won't be affected by these things. Because then it's like desire for liberation. In other words, you have to accept that there's some modes of nature and just kind of tolerate it and not feel aversion or what Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, forced renunciation. And at the same time, there shouldn't be a hankering to enjoy the modes. That means he's not trying to get out of the body. He accepts he has this body, and he just uses it for the service of the Lord. And gradually, he transcends all of the modes. But in the meantime, you know, till he's a Mahabhagavan, then he's just neutral. And he just continues doing his bhajan, his serving, his service. But this neutrality seems to be the main causes for bringing oneself to this neutral position. You're practicing being neutral, and that is Shuddha Sattva. There's no modes of nature, there's no transformations of all of these things going on. Because if one hates them and is too much averse, then it's kind of like liberation. It's leaning towards gyan. And then there's some feeling, hankering for liberation and to get out of the body, to get free from the body, like this. Anyway, that's just the first verse. And so this is something that you can only perceive in yourself. whether there's attachment or illusion or illumination. Other people, they can't see that readily just by looking at your face. Of course, if they know you for a long time, then gradually they can perceive your behavior. But here's the rest of it is his achara, his behavior. Udasinavat asino. He's like neutral. This is similar to the first verse. Guner yo na vichalyate. He's not disturbed. And the modes are present. Guna vartanti ityevam yo vatishtati nengate. So he doesn't like make effort. Nengate. That's what my note says. No effort. What is Prabhupada's translation of this? Nengate? Na engate. Never flickers. Then sama dukkha sukha swasta. He's sama. He's equally situated within himself and sees happiness and distress as the same. And sama loshtashma kanchana. He sees the gold and pebbles and gold all the same. We discussed that in the fifth chapter a little bit. Tulya priya priyo. He's equal in, you know, when things are very pleasant or unpleasant. Dhira, he's sober in the light of pleasure and pleasant and unpleasant events. Tulya nindatma samstuti. He's equal in ninda and stuti, praise and blame. Mana pamanayos tulyas, he's also equal in honor and dishonor. That's almost the same thing, huh? Tulya mitrari paksha. He's equal to friends and enemies. Paksha means group, right? Groups of friends and enemies. Huh? Don't talk. Savaramba parityagi. He renounces all actions, material actions. Gunatita sa'uchite. Such a person is above the modes. Prabhupada writes in the second paragraph of his purport, the next question concerns the dealings of a transcendentally situated person. A materially situated person is affected by so-called honor and dishonor to the body, but the transcendentally situated person is not affected by such false honor and dishonor. He performs his duty in Krishna consciousness and does not mind whether a man honors or dishonors him. He accepts things that are favorable for his duty in Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, he has no necessity of anything material, either a stone or gold. He takes everyone as his dear friend who helps him in his execution of Krishna consciousness, and he does not hate his so-called enemy. We see this kind of neutrality in the fifth canto, third chapter, verse 24, which is about Judd Bharat. It describes in 5:13:24 when Rahugana was shouting his harsh words at Judd Bharat, and in that verse it says that Judd Bharat, there are waves of dissatisfaction in the mind of Judd Bharat. But then he he was neutral to that. In other words, he kind of just, by the power of his bhakti, his transcendence, he was able to transcend that. So he was neutral. He didn't become angry. But it does say, Prabhupada does say in the purport that he felt insulted. And then it says that his senses were certainly, Prabhupada writes, his senses were certainly agitated when he was insulted by King Rahugana. So it's a very good example of what it means here to being neutral, but at the same time not being a robot or stone-hearted, something like this. Because often devotees read these symptoms and they kind of interpret it as becoming callous without feelings, like a robot or a stone. But actually, the pure devotee is quite sensitive, and because he feels love for the Lord, so his heart is very soft. And thus, he's very sensitive, and certainly Jed Bharat felt hurt from the sharp words of King Rahugana. It wasn't that he didn't feel anything. He had the feelings, but then he kind of somehow, you know, just waited, and then his bhakti was his power of his bhakti allowed him to neutralize those things, and therefore he didn't react like knee-jerk, as we were saying before, right? He didn't just shout back at Rahugana, "How dare you say this to me? Don't you know, you know, I'm a self-realized soul?" Right? He wouldn't say that. So he felt it, he heard it, he felt it, he waited, and then he didn't react on the material platform. But he did feel those things. And similarly, Dhruva Maharaj, in the third canto, or in the fourth canto, 10th chapter, verse 4, there it describes how he becomes angry and feels lamentation, even. He feels grief by the death of his brother Uttam, who was killed by the Yakshas. And Prabhupada writes there in the commentary that it is not contradictory or incompatible that a great devotee grieves or feels anger or lamentation. So these things are there. As long as the human body is there, there's going to be some feelings and some, you know, interactions. And the devotee feels those things, even on the Mahabhagavat level. But he just doesn't react to them in the same way as a conditioned soul. That's the difference, because the power of his bhakti allows him to transcend them. But it's not that it becomes like a stone. You know, just trying to imitate a kind of callous, to become callous and feelingless, that is not the symptoms of the higher levels of bhakti. And sometimes in our attempts, in our neophyte attempts to rise above the modes of nature, we sometimes act impersonally towards one another because we see that tulya mitrari pakshayo. We're supposed to be equal to friends and enemies, so therefore we're not friendly to anybody. But actually, as mentioned previously in the 11th chapter, nirvarar sarvabhuteshu. He's friendly to everyone. He's not an enemy to anyone. And also as mentioned, advaishta sarvabhutanam maitra karuna evacha. The devotee is very merciful and kind. He's a kind friend to everyone. So it's not that the devotee is unfriendly equally to everybody, but rather he's friendly to everybody equally. See, sometimes we get it backwards, you know. We're supposed to be friendly to everyone, even to our enemy, and that is the symptom of our neutrality, because we're seeing everyone as part and parcel of Krishna, and we love Krishna, and so we feel some kinship with all living entities, not just the humans, but even the animals. So we feel some kind feelings to them. Maitra karuna evaja. Sometimes, as I'm saying, that we may mistake this neutrality to be impersonalism or kind of forced callousness without emotion, with, you know, being free from any feelings. And I've seen the kind of, I wrote in my book about this, and I've seen in many places, you know, anyway, I wrote in the London temple, I was chanting my rounds, and the devotee lifted my arm to look at the what time it was. And he looked at my watch and he put my arm down. Then he walked away without saying anything or looking into my eyes. And also, when I was teaching at Bhaktivedanta Manor for about 7 years or so, I started noticing the behavior of the devotees was different. That if there was a group of new devotees who were in the temple for like 6 months or less than a year, then when I gave a class, when I made a joke, they would laugh. And when I spoke strongly, then they would take it very seriously. And then if I whispered, and then I said, yes, Krishna Balaram, they went into the forest, then they would all come forward. They were like, you know, with me, you know, fully, psychologically, emotionally. But then the devotees that were in the temple for 3 years or more, when I made a joke, they didn't show any. When I spoke strongly, and Prabhupada said, "You rascal!" You know, then they. If I told something, some story, and I spoke something like this, and they didn't show any feelings or any emotions. They weren't with me in the class, you know. So it was as if we were training them to not exhibit any feelings. And I began to wonder, is this right, or are we actually helping these people to become transcendental? Is this a symptom of transcendence? And then I began to realize it's not. Although, of course, we're helping people. We're giving them the holy name. We're giving them Bhagavatam and the worship of the deity and prasadam and harinam, this and that. But it's kind of like the way we're approaching our behavior to one another and for oneself is something not quite right. There was something wrong. It was like we were shooting for a false level of transcendence which didn't express any feeling. And I started wondering about, you know, is this are we helping these people or what, you know? Because you need to actually engage your emotions and feelings in the process of Krishna consciousness, along with your intelligence, your body, your mind, your words, and your endeavors. Because a human being is composed of a composite whole. There's these, you know, it's not just the brain. There's also the heart, there's feelings, there's emotions, there's intelligence, there's also the body, you know, and there's all of these things have to be engaged, fully engaged. And see, because I was noticing this, maybe it's not so prominent in India, but it's much more prominent in the West. I don't have so much experience in India, but I'm sure that it's somewhat present here in this country too. Maybe not in this temple so much, but I don't know. So, like, I knew one devotee in America, and I was working in this temple for years, and he was a senior devotee. He was a good preacher. He gave classes. He was a hard worker, and he was respected by everyone. He was a brahmachari for 20 years. And I was working with him, and I respected him. I was friends with him. But I always noticed that he didn't ever express any feelings. And I always kind of wondered about that. But I never drew any conclusions, but I made some observations, and I just, you know. But then, like, after 20 years, suddenly this person just fell in love with a young girl and then just disappeared with her from the community, you know. And he was in that temple for like 20 years, 15 years, something like this. So the devotees were in the community were shocked. What happened to this fellow, you know? But so what happened was he was not engaging, or, you know, his feelings, his emotions, rather was kind of like stuffing them in his back pocket and kind of suppressing them. He wasn't purifying them. He wasn't taking them along with him in the process of Krishna consciousness. So they didn't get purified. So when a certain time came, he felt a need for expression of emotion and some intimacy and whatever. And then, you know, there was this great conflict. And then he, you know, kind of grew his hair long and he went out and he got married, so working outside and like this. It was very, very strange. So, and there have been very senior members of our movement, sannyasis and gurus, who actually exhibited the same kind of behavior. So it wasn't just these big famous people, but there were also other not so famous, but and sincere devotees. They weren't, you know, I'm not saying that they're evil or anything like that, but they just didn't actually practice Krishna consciousness fully in the proper way, and they were denying parts of themselves. And later, after, I don't know, 15 years or something, a long time, those parts of themselves kind of came back on them and kind of overpowered them, because they didn't take those parts along with them in the process of Krishna consciousness. They kind of kept them stuffed down. So actually we have to engage all parts of ourselves in the process. And in this way, we see, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes a kind of forced renunciation, right? And that is not beneficial and doesn't bring one above the modes of nature. So I guess you could ask, you know, well, how can you tell when it's forced renunciation? I don't know. Is that your question? Okay. It's hard for me to say. I mean, because, you know, I'm not Bhaktivinoda Thakur or anything, but that was my perception. Because, you know, I knew this person. I was actually friends with this person. I worked with him. And I felt that, you know, I mean, sometimes he laughed, I mean, but it wasn't, he didn't ever express any deep feelings. It's hard to say, it's just like he was out of touch with a part of himself. That's, I mean, as far as I can describe it, you know. I don't know exactly what, you know, the remedy for that is. But I've observed this, you know, behavior in devotees in for many years, and I always felt that it wasn't quite right, but I didn't know exactly what was wrong. But then when I started seeing what was the reaction after a long period of time, then I said, you know, something. Now I understand what is the reaction, because you can see from the reaction. More, you can understand more about what the problem is. I mean, I can't say that I know this, you know, phenomena completely, and I can describe it. I tried to describe it in the book that I wrote a little bit, as much as I could. But I sort of kind of a forced renunciation or suppression or repression. I forget the name. One of them is negative, and the other one is acceptable. That's just English words, but one of them is where you, like, unconsciously are denying parts, feelings, and whatever, of emotions in yourself. And the other one is when you're consciously trying to control your senses and your mind, and that's acceptable. But when it happens unconsciously and a feeling comes up and you just kind of, you have an automatic kind of subconscious thing, you know, stuffing it down. And then you stuff all these things down, and then it's kind of like a jack-in-the-box and springs out in 15 years or 10 years or something, and it just kind of attacks you. A lot of energy on the subtle plane, you know, being stuffed down. As I say, I can't say that I fully understand it, but I've seen it and I've seen the results. So therefore, I have some understanding of it because I've seen it. And so, as far as the remedy, it seems that just being more open, being more friendly, being more human. I think if one is doing that and not trying to show everyone, you know, how renounced he is, falsely, because that's dveshti, and that's part of the gyan marg, actually. It's not bhakti. The devotee is neutral. He doesn't have dveshti, right? Like I said, in the Gaudiya Gita, Krishna is describing the adhikar for the bhakta. And Rupa Goswami quotes this verse in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And he says, Naati, what are the words? Yadrachaya matkatasu jata shradastu yapama nanirvino nati sakto. So nanirvino, it's not, he doesn't hate everything too much. Nati sakto, he's not too attached. So they hear the same words, dveshti and kankshati. This represents like karma and jnana. Dveshti is jnana, and kankshati is karma. So he's not too attached or hankering for these things, and he's not forcing himself to renounce them in an artificial way. Nanirvino nati sakto. Bhakti yoga sasidida. So a person who's like that in between, he's neutral, then he can become a devotee. But the other persons, they can't. If they're trying too hard to renounce the world, or if they're trying too hard to enjoy the world, the devotee's like just serving Krishna. So if a person too much trying to renounce the world, then when he has some feelings, maybe a need for intimacy, or if he wants to express some feelings or emotions, or he requires some friendship or some intimacy, and then he thinks, oh, this is not respected in the community. This is, I'll be seen as a weakling. No one will respect me like that. Then maybe the person tries to, you know, gradually, subconsciously stuffing these things away. And then later, they come up again. So it's better just to be open, upfront, honest with oneself and with others, and like I said, also friendly. I think just if the devotees are just a little bit more human and more friendly, then they won't have these problems. It's quite simple, actually. I'm not saying that I don't see this here, but in places I go, especially in the West, it's very prominent. I've done these seminars, like love and trust seminars, where I get devotees to talk together and ask each other questions, a little bit like we're doing here. And I have this love and trust seminar, which is kind of scientifically designed to gradually break down those barriers. And the person opens his heart, and then he's expressing honestly what he thinks about the other devotee. And there's some really amazing results. The devotees, they just open up everything, and then they start talking, and they're moving their hands, and they're talking in such a way, you know, like this. I mean, for like 20, 30 minutes, they're like, rah, rah, rah. And then at the end, I ask, okay, now embrace your partner. And everyone goes, oh. And then I asked the devotees, what is your feedback? How did you like this thing? And I get amazing, you know, kind of feedback. People raise their hand and say, well, I've been coming to this temple for 3 years. One lady said in Russia, and she said, I've seen this other lady coming here, and she lives outside, and I live in the temple, but I always thought she wasn't so serious as me, that she's not really a good devotee, not a serious devotee because she lives outside. But now after talking to her, I can see that she's more serious than I am. and I take her, and I have great respect for her. Now we've become very good friends. I want to thank you so much. Oh, great, okay. And, amongst the brahmacharis in another temple, there was the head, one of the pujaris. He raises, I want to thank you for making this seminar. I saw this devotee in the temple for 2 years, and I would never talk to him. I just said Hari Bol when we passed in the hallway. But now I had the chance to talk to him, and now we're very close friends. So now I have another very good friend. I just wanted to thank you. Like this. And then I was in another country and I did the same thing. And at the end, a devotee raised his hand and I called on him. I said, what was your response? You know, how did you like this? He said, when I embrace my partner, I felt my false ego explode. You know, so I had these very intense seminars with people because I found that, at least in the West, there were a lot of barriers, social, psychological, emotional barriers between the devotees, where they didn't talk to each other, they didn't open up to each other, they didn't reveal their hearts to another. Rupa Goswami, that's one of the main, Pritilakshana. So you're opening yourself and you're discussing intimately. Guhyam akyati prichyati. Right? That can't happen. Guhyam means it's confidential. Akyati prichyati. You're talking and you're asking and you're hearing, and that means you have to be very open. So that's maybe because your community has like this counselor system, and perhaps this has helped you and you don't have this problem so much. But in other places, it can be very bad. Wow, you know. So I've noticed these things being in ISKCON for 28 years. And when I see these kind of verses, I know that a lot of people misinterpret them or they kind of hear them in the wrong way. Because it sounds like a very callous person. Like I told you the story, you know, how Prabhupada, when he saw the dead person, he was like this. And then, but when he saw the people waiting in the bus, he started waiting for the bus. Then he was crying, you know. So, in certain circumstances, yeah, what can be done? The man's killed. And of course, the woman's crying, so what to do, you know. Yeah, but in some other circumstances, Prabhupada felt just compassion for the living entities in general who are in the material world, who are just hanging around waiting for the bus. You know. So, anyway, that's about as much as I can say about this. If someone has another, yes. Yeah, that's the way. Our main way to transcend the modes is just to serve Krishna, from whatever platform we're already on. Yeah, because that shows that you're understanding that you're not the body. So the first thing is kind of introspection, that you're noticing, oh, my body is being influenced by passion now. You can't get rid of it, but I mean, you can try to control it a little bit. That's the idea. So, a person who is passionate, so he may be doing very active service, and he should know, yes, my nature is to be a little passionate, and I'm being very active now, and that's good for me. And, you know, by my chanting and by my prayer to Krishna and Didi Seva and Kirtan and all the things that I do, gradually all these things will go away. But, you know, Prabhupada also instituted the rising early and showering and all of these things and cleanliness. So that kind of minimizes the lower modes of nature. So we can't get rid of them completely, but we want to minimize the lower modes, and we want to maximize the mode of goodness, because that will give us better results in prasa bhakti. So Prabhupada says here, he need not try to become free from the influence of the modes of nature, because he cannot. But you can minimize the lower modes and you can maximize the higher modes. Yeah. And then making some adjustments in our behavior, like I was describing, some of these subtle things. Yeah, Shuddha Sattva Visheshatma Prema Suryangsa Samyabhak. So this verse describes Bhava Bhakti, and when we come to Bhava, then the modes of nature are not affecting us. So, but then that means actually the body's changed. It means you don't have a material body anymore. It means you have a spiritual body and a spiritual mind. The gross and subtle body, just like if you offer a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water to the Lord, we accept that the food becomes transcendental, right? The flower becomes transcendental, the potato or whatever fruit, vegetable you offer, that becomes transcendental. So if you offer yourself, you also become transcendental, right? So that means karmana manasagira. You're offering yourself to Krishna, and you're Hari Dasa, right? Into Hari, you serve him with all of these things, and then you're actually liberated, because then the body transforms above the modes of nature at Bhava. So that means you don't even have a mature body anymore. That's his main focus. The things that I'm recommending just help to give up the Purusha Bhav and to try to maximize the mode of goodness. And that's also recommended in different places, to minimize the lower modes and maximize the higher modes. But you, not that you try to just give up all modes, and that your main focus is, because you can't do that anyway, it's impossible. And even, we'll hear later how the Jnani also has to renounce his knowledge. You know, something connected to this. Well, you're limited to the degree, I guess, that you feel comfortable practicing in that way. Like you may minimize your eating, but you are limited by the fact that your body needs a certain amount of, you know, nourishment, or how much you're attached to that nourishment. So you may minimize, or you may cut down on your eating, but you can't cut down too much, because otherwise, as you say, then there'll be a kind of reaction to it in the opposite direction. Kind of like a rubber band. You know, you stretch it too far and it breaks. Right? So you can stretch it, but there's a limit. According to the rubber band, every rubber band has a different capacity. You know? So every devotee knows that capacity, and then he acts accordingly. But as far as our, you know, our food is all prasadam anyway, so it's above the modes of nature. The only thing we try to control is our trying to enjoy it just for its good taste, which is not recommended, because otherwise then we get into, you know, this Purusha Bhav, this enjoying mood, and that stops us from being Krishna conscious. We forget that we're a servant. So, I mean, mainly the devotees dealing with these kind of things, more like psychological to give, you know, to give up this enjoying mood than just struggling with the modes of nature. I mean, the devotees generally don't struggle too much with the modes of nature because they rise early, they're going in front of the deity, they're chanting the holy name, they're showering once, twice, three times a day, you know, so they're living very sattvic life. And taking prasadam, it's nirgun, transcendental food. The mantra that we're chanting is the highest, the agama, shastra, we're chanting is the highest, the apa, the food and the water we're taking is the highest. It's all nirgun, right? Bhagavad Purana is the Amala Purana. The association we have is all bhaktas, our praja. Our dhyan is on Radha Kunja Bihari and Gauranitai. You know, if you look at all those 10 things, it's like our karma is to do devotional service, right? All of the things we, you know, we couldn't get any higher, actually. For devotees, they can't do much adjusting to boost it any higher, right? I mean, unless you're, you know, driving a taxi in Bombay, like I said, right? You might adjust it there. Or instead of putting 20 chilies in the sabji, you know, which is a half a liter of sabji, you know, you might put one and see how that maybe is good enough. You know, there might be some adjustments on that scale. But I mean, in general, overall, by and large, we have the best of all of those 10 things. But sometimes we may be injecting, you know, our cultural or modes of nature or whatever, our own nature into that, into these transcendental activities, and we're causing ourselves more modes of nature, kind of, you know. Instead of driving a taxi in Bombay, why not get an office job 9 to 5? Or work in a shop selling sweaters or clothes or whatever. You know, I mean, there's so many things that one can do. Why choose this kind of job? You know. So, in this way, there are some adjustments can be made. At least especially for people that are working and living outside of the temple. He's trying to give an example for the thing I spoke about before. Ah. Prabhupada would say, tell this person to stop shouting in the microphone like a rakshas. Okay, so the body's made of modes of nature, and the sense objects are made modes of nature. The subtle body's being affected by the modes of nature. All the surroundings are affected by the modes of nature. Mainly the Baddha Jiva is controlled by this Adi Daivik and Adi Bhautik, Purusha. There's the devas are controlling the senses, and the sense objects are in different modes of nature, and the modes are within us, and it's all impelling us and to act in certain ways. But we have that body because we wanted that body from our previous existence. So everything's ultimately coming from the soul, but the soul's desire is simply to enjoy. So he can enjoy with Krishna, serving Krishna, or he can try to enjoy the material realm, the external sense objects. So all of these things are there. I mean, there's the force of the jiva is simply to want to enjoy. But then the demigods are assisting. The Lord gives through their agency a body made of senses and a certain birth in a certain place and certain parents, and the body is, you know, born in, with certain modes of nature prominent, with certain varna. And so that's all facilitating the jiva to act in the way that he wanted to act and to get the sense objects that he wanted. So then you have certain senses which accommodate those desires. So, you know, it's like being in a prison and you got there and now you have to live in that prison and you're limited by the activities there in prison. So everything is a factor in the entire makeup of the person. It's not just his own desire, or is it not just the modes of nature forcing him and the soul is like helpless in this regard? In one sense he's helpless, but he's the one who put himself there. And he, from his desire, has created that situation. So now he has to ride along with that situation. And by serving the Lord and hearing, and gradually he can transform his desires and gradually his subtle body. Right from the very beginning of his practice of bhakti sadhana, the Lord begins to transform that Sharanagata Bhakta, his modes of nature are changing, and his spiritual body, mind, senses, and intelligence are all growing right from the beginning when he starts his bhakti sadhana. So then after some time, unknown to him, it's invisibly happening, gradually the subtle the spiritual senses and mind replace the material mind and material senses. Proportionately, they go like this. And it happens gradually, unseen by the practitioner, till he comes to this Vaidushya Pratyaksha and Bhava Bhakti. Then he has a spiritual body, a subtle body. That's Jivan Mukta Suchite, and then he's liberated. So then he doesn't have a material body, you know. Of course, even such a person, you know, needs to sleep, even if it's 3 hours or whatever, but, and there's some, you know, in order to sleep, you have to be in ignorance to some certain degree. But even that person who's in that, he has a spiritual body, then he's dreaming of Krishna also. He's always doing service. Mm-hmm. So when he wakes up, it's not like, you know, where am I? Who am I? What time is it? You know, he wakes up and he's like wide awake. You know, he knows, we don't even know where we are or what time it is. And you know, did you ever wake up and some other place and then you forget, where am I, you know? What's going on here? Like, for half a minute, right? You're like, some elevated soul, when he goes to sleep and he wakes up, it's not like that. He's like, he just, there's no heavy modes there. But he sleeps anyway, a little bit. Then Prabhupada would sometimes go to sleep. And when we would wake up, he'd start speaking as if he never fell asleep. Like the next sentence. Yeah, it's just like a pause. He kind of went off into some other place, and then he came back, and then he just continued from where he left off. Can we open this door now and put on this fan? That's okay. That's all right. So the next two verses are very philosophical, and there's a lot of commentary, and they're very important verses. So better we do them tomorrow. Because you'll probably have a million questions about them also. And just the two verses will probably consist a whole class. It could be like that anyway. But otherwise, we can start the beginning of chapter 15, but we'll see how it goes. But at least I should go over these subjects again and rehash them. Because I haven't given a Bhagavad Gita seminar since 98. So it's been 5 years now. And I can't say that I remember every single thing about this. I do have to kind of review. Okay. So we'll stop now, and we'll have a class tomorrow, probably 3:30 or 4, like today. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki.